So tonight I want to continue with this series, this class of 6 weeks I've been working on. This is week four. We got all the way to the fourth noble truth. But the fourth noble truth is so huge that I'm actually going to split it into three parts so that I can cover it adequately. And actually, the fourth noble truth, which is, the Eightfold Path, breaks very nicely into three sections anyway. So tonight what I want to do is talk about the first two sections of the path called wise understanding or view and wholesome intention. And I'm quite consciously not using the word right, which is how these were all originally translated. It used to be, and you'll see it all over the place. You'll see right understanding and right intention. I feel uncomfortable with the word right because it has this sort of, waving finger energy to it, right? Like, if there's a right, there's got to be a wrong, right? So instead, there's use like wise and wholesome and skillful are, I'll tend to use. I might slip back into the word right just because it's so embedded in the teachings and in my practice over the years, but I want to sort of lean away from the right wrong dichotomy. So the first thing we got to know is these two steps or sections of the Eightfold Path are sort of getting us going in a sense. It's like, what is it that makes me want to go do something, which is wise understanding or wise view, and how do I do that, which is wholesome intention, like how do I get going in the right direction? And in many places in the sutta, the Buddha says something along the lines of everything else on the path, everything else arises from right view. Like we have to start there. If we have the wrong view, if we don't understand and we start to practice, we could be practicing in ways that are inappropriate or, lead us astray and we get lost in the wilderness. The wilderness being typically what we're thinking in our mind more than anything else, but this is something we have to pay attention to right at the very beginning. And I want to read a little bit from the sutta here. It's from the Majjhima Nikaya. And this is a teaching called the Great 40. And I think it's just because it's got 40 verses in it, but it's like. Anyhow, he's talking about right view. Therein, because right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong view as wrong view and right view as right view. This is one's right view. So you have to understand that there are views you could take that would be incorrect, would lead you astray. Already we're falling into right and wrong, but that's part of how the teachings are written too. And what bhikkhus is right view? Right view, I say, is twofold. There is right view that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in acquisitions, in other words, daily life. And there is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. And what bhikkhus is right view? That is affected by taints, partaking of merit, and ripening in acquisition. There's what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There's fruit and result of good and bad actions. There's this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are born spontaneously. There are in the world good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and other world. This is right view affected by taints, partaking of merit, and ripening in acquisition. It's quite a list. Here's yet another list in the Buddhist teachings. And I want to spend some time talking about some of these because it's, you know, part of this is like deeply cultural from 2,500 years ago, and part of it is just I trying to understand what he's talking about here. And so the first thing he says, there's what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. He's talking very directly here about generosity. How, and this is very classical Buddhist teaching. Every time the Buddha went to a new place, and he was a wandering sadhu, right? So he went to a lot of new places. He always spoke about dana first. And this is because it's one of those practices, because dana is a practice, you know, generosity is a practice, but anyone can practice it. You don't have to have any special qualifications. You don't need any great intellectual understanding. You don't need anything other than an open heart willing to give. And so generosity is always the first, every list I've ever seen of how to begin. And basically, the other thing with generosity is it gladdens the heart. And it sort of opens the heart to things outside ourselves. If we're giving, if we're being generous, then just the act itself always makes us happy if we're doing it sincerely. And it's and we're acting in a way that is connecting us to others, seeing that connection, that we're not just our little selves tucked away, that we're part of a larger collective. That hopefully just widens to everyone over time. So that's the first thing he says. Then he's talking about the results of good and bad actions. And this is also really important. It's like we need to understand that every intentional act of body and speech, every time we intentionally do something, it has consequences. It's intention. Note the word intention. So this isn't things like, you know, you're walking along and someone bumps you and you spill their drink. Well, that's just stuff that happens. It wasn't an intentional act. It has no results at all. But other than that, everything else we do that's a conscious choice, whether through action or through speech, these consequences shape our lives. They affect how, what comes next. They're just right now, and also in the future. I mean, it could be something you did 20 years ago, and then something happens, and that action, whatever it was, arises in some way in your life now, and you have to deal with it, whether it's something wholesome or something unwholesome. And this is just the nature of things. And I'm not, and quite intentionally, not talking about reincarnation and those sorts of things. So that is part of the traditional teachings. But you can just look this, just look in your life, and you can think of something that you, some choice you made 10 years ago, and if you think about it, you see how it's affected your life right now. How it's coming to fruit in your life right now. That's just the nature of everything. You know, all our actions of that are started with intention lead to other things later on. It's just the nature of having a human life. Then mother and father. First I went, mother and father, what's that doing in there, right? But think about, he says, think about the debt we owe them simply because they brought us into the world and raised us. And it might be, and this can be difficult for some people who perhaps don't have or didn't have a particularly wonderful relationship with their parents. But even if it wasn't a wonderful relationship, without them, you wouldn't be here. It's that, I mean, that's a biological fact, right? And we have to always be able to think that we owe them something. We owe them a debt for bringing us into the world in the first place. And remember that. And furthermore, if it seems right, if it seems like a good idea to you, and you know them, and you want to share a little bit about the Dhamma, what you're learning with them, it's a perfectly all right thing to do. It's like, they're deserving of understanding the Dhamma as much as anybody else. In fact, maybe more so because of this special connection you have to them. But, here's the but, the big but, right? But don't expect them to go, oh, isn't this great? I want to study with you and blah, blah, blah. They might go something like, as my mother used to say, well, that's nice, dear. And that's okay too. That's okay too. That might be, and if it doesn't seem appropriate, don't, if it's like, oh, if I know if I go there, this is just going to cause a big stir. Just don't go there. It's okay. You don't have to do it. But if it seems like it might be fruitful, useful for you as well as for them, then it's fine. And this also, why, by the way, goes for other members of your family. Maybe, you've got a sibling who you think, oh, they might be interested in this, and you can just share this tiny little bit and see what happens, And they say, oh yeah, and boy, the Avalanche aren't doing too well this year. They want to talk about something else. That'll be young. Okay, no sense going there. But there's a but to the but even. Don't proselytize. Don't go out there and say, this is really changing my life. You should do this too. It'll change your life. It'll make your life way more wonderful, blah, blah, blah. And that may be true, but it just puts people off. Really puts people off. So just don't even think about going there. It's just, you can slide it in small ways. And the truth is, if you're sincerely practicing and it's cha it, you are changing big because you're practicing. And it's bound to be in a more whole, in a wholesome way. They're gonna notice that at some level. They're gonna go, oh, yeah. I think of my brother and sister who are both really different than me in terms of how they lead their lives and that sort of stuff. But they're like, oh yeah, they're really sort of interested enough to go, well, that's okay, and that's really interesting, and I can see how this is seems like a good thing for you. And and they leave it at there. They're not really interested in going off and sitting or anything like that. Other than say on a beach someplace, they might want to sit on the beach. But so it's just everybody finds their own thing, right? And then there's another section here, and this is really understand. And this is I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein about this actually. And then we have to understand that there are enlightened beings in the world right now. He says, dropping his jaw in surprise. But it's true. The people are all there's always more beings becoming enlightened by the Buddhist teachings, or in some other total tradition for that matter. And we have to acknowledge that. And this is what Joseph has to say. And he's talking about this in the sense of it might be hard to take that in because, all men are created equal. That's what says that right in the Constitution, right? Our egalitarian values can sometimes diminish the understanding that there are actually people wiser than ourselves, people from whom we can genuinely learn about the Dhamma, the truth, the way things are. Acknowledging this also keeps us open to wisdom from unexpected sources. We learn to listen for that voice of genuine experience, rather than being influenced positively or negatively by personality or position. Recognizing that there are genuinely wise and awakened beings in the world helps us reaffirm the understanding that wisdom and awakening are possible for us as well. They can do it, why can't I? This is part of right view. We can practice applying various aspects of mundane right view in different ways. Some may be obvious to us, like practicing generosity, which bears wholesome fruit, or investigating our motivations and acting on the wholesome and letting go of the unwholesome. Other aspects of this right view may not be immediately apparent. We may want to experiment to see how they affect the quality of our lives. What Joseph is saying, and what the Buddha also says, is this is a practice. Right view is something we can practice. Just like everything else the Buddha teaches, we have to practice it. We have to explore it, see where it fits with how we think. And not only that, it says that in the sutta, right? One makes an effort to abandon wrong view and to enter upon right view. This is one's right effort. Mindfully, one abandons wrong view. Mindfully, one enters upon and abides in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three states run and circle around right view. That is, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. So now he's talking about steps in the path later on. But he's saying how this, he's pointing to the fact that this is a practice, number one. You know, right effort and right mindfulness are those are the practice steps. But he's also saying, you know, we don't look at these things as the street, well, eight things, like eight bricks or something. They're all interrelated and they interweave and play with each other quite distinctly. And we have to be careful not to think of them as separate things. They're all very strongly interrelated. Then there's this idea that besides this, so this is what we've been talking about, right view in the sense of how we live our lives in the world. But he says, there's also right view unaffected by taints, taints being anything that would lead us to away from right view, or noble right view, right? The reason we practice is that this practice leads to enlightenment. Period. This is right view in the noble sense of like, this is what we have to always understand because we keep forgetting. We can't be satisfied with something less, like being a good person or being happier. Not that those things aren't going to happen as you practice, because it's certainly in my experience, you know, how I am in the world over time, you know, my many years of practice, it's quite distinctly different in a wholesome way. But that's not the reason I practice. You know, and that's the danger that we can fall into of accepting, well, I'll just, you know, I'll keep practicing because I want to be a better person. Well, yeah, but that's not the reason you practice. Well, a little bit more from Joseph Goldstein here. Second, noble right view is described in terms of its objective content. That is, what wisdom discovers as it illuminates our experience. And in the Mahapatisatipatthana Sutta, the Buddha equates this liberating right view specifically to the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And what, monks, is right view? It is, monks, the knowledge of dukkha, the knowledge of the origin of dukkha, the knowledge of the cessation of dukkha. Oh, the first three steps on that, yeah. First three noble truths, and the knowledge of the way of practicing leading to the cessation of dukkha. This is called right view. So right view is a pointing to we understand, or we're deepening our understanding. It's a process of the first three noble truths. That the the truth of suffering in the world, the truth of the cause, which is tanha, grasping, and the fact that it can end, that just letting go of grasping, letting go of clinging, is the cessation of dukkha. And we understand this when there's no other goal, there's no other reason for doing. And no other, nothing else to, this is the end of the practice. It's both the beginning, which is brilliant. This is the beginning. This is what we have to start with. We have to understand that those three noble truths are there. That's why we're practicing the fourth noble truth. And understand that, in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the practice section of the Satipatthana Sutta, the very last thing you do is come to a true understanding of the four noble truths. So this is both the beginning and the end of the practice. And it's something that develops over time. And so, and this is the one of the last things I want to say about right view, in a sense. It's that we have to understand that our right view, our wholesome view, is going to change over time. We start the, wherever you are in your practice now, whether you're fairly near the beginning, you've been practicing for a long time, whatever, it doesn't make any difference. You have some concept, some understanding of wholesome view, wise view. And then as we practice and we learn things and we go deeper into the practice, we're going to come all the way back to right view again and realize that our view has matured, has changed, has deepened. And that will then take us deeper into the practice. And then we come around again. So this is the danger of calling the Eightfold Path a path. A path implies, a straight line in a sense, or at least a line that has steps. And the Buddhist teachings are very more like a spiral. We keep coming around to the same issues again, but we have a better understanding of them that leads us to have form a stronger intention, which makes us want to practice more, blah, 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 and around we go and around we go, over and over and over again. So we keep coming back to things that we thought we had all figured out, I suppose. So we've been talking about wholesome view, wise view. How do we, what happens, what is it that causes us to fall into unwise view? What is it that, and Joseph has this great line here, this great section. Bhikkhus, I do not see even a single thing so blameworthy as wrong view. This is the Buddha again. There's nothing so blameworthy as wrong view. There's a teaching called the 10 Unwholesome Acts of Body, Speech, and Mind. The last one is wrong view, and it contains all the others. Let me read what Joseph has to say here. Why does the Buddha make such a strong declaration about this wrong view of self? It is because so many of our unwholesome actions, with their attendant results, are born from it. As long as this view is the central understanding of our lives, and it is for most people, we spend energy and effort gratifying the self, defending it, holding on to it, and yet all of this potent energy and activity is revolving around something that isn't even there. This is the obscuring power of delusion. This is what we do. We keep acting from a place of thinking that we're separate. And this always causes us to suffer more, not less. A few examples show how our ordinary way of viewing experience is unknowingly strengthening wrong view. I feel happy, I feel miserable, and I am delighted are all wrong view about mental feelings. It's a pretty big deal. Thinking, especially if anybody's a psychologist, has a therapist who says those things all the time, right? I want to do this, to see this, to hear this, to go there, are all delusions about the mental factor of desire. We add the I and mind to the working of an impersonal factor. I make an effort. I have concentration is wrong view about those two qualities. We can analyze almost every aspect of our daily life and see how we are continually identifying with different states of minds, moods, and emotions that arise and creating and strengthening the sense of self in the process. This is the heart truth of the Buddhist teachings that's hard to take in. And I want to point out that the Buddha said, there he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, about to be enlightened. He said the last thing he had to deal with was a subtle sense of self. So this is, a lifelong project. This is not going to be easy, and we have to understand that. But at the same time, we should be aware of how often we are, and this is the Buddhist term, selfing. Over and over again, creating a sense of a separate self. By our, even by the words we use and how we describe things. And I had a teacher who said, we have to practice things like instead of saying, I am happy, you need to learn to say, think, happiness has arisen. No I there. Just that's what's being experienced right now is happiness. Happiness has arisen. It's just how we, because we're changing the wording that we use mentally or we use when we're talking to other people shifts how we connect to it. On the other hand, I'm not suggesting you never use the word I in conversation with other people because they'll think you're really weird. Let's be honest. You say, how are you? Oh, happiness has arisen. And you go, look at you like, yeah, sure. Okay, what are you smoking? It's so you have to be aware of that too, that it can't just, that you have to sort of be careful. But it's more how we think than how we actually speak in the world that I think Joseph and I are both concerned with. So that's right. That's all the aspects of right view. It's both how we act in the world and how we think, and how our thoughts and our process of thinking, especially about our self, can become wrong view, or our wrong view. And we have to gradually shift away from that sort of thinking. And then, so now let's say, oh, now we have wholesome view. Now what do we do? Well, now we have to have wholesome intention. We have to go, okay, I see, basically, through my wholesome view, my wise understanding, that I have to do something. I have to do something about this. I can't just stay stuck here. I have to move in the right direction. And this is what where wholesome intention arises, right? First off, intention, the actual intention itself is simply a mental formation that must always arise before we do any act of body or speech. Before I can say that what I just said, I had to have the mental formation of intention arise to say that sentence or wave my hand like this. I have to make have intention to wave my hand before I wave my hand. And so intention is always going on. And so if we can have wholesome intention, if we can be aware enough to make our intention more wholesome, that's going to move us in the correct direction, in the in a better practice. And a lot of this, we have to understand that intention in and of itself, the actual mental factor of intention, is totally neutral. We can have wholesome intention or unwholesome intention. And then we act or speak on those wholesome or unwholesome things. There's this famous story about someone named Angulimala. Now, Anguli is finger, and Mala is necklace. And this is a famous bandit who had this habit of murdering people and cutting off one of their fingers and putting it on this necklace that hung around his neck. And the story goes that he had 999 fingers, and he wanted to make it all the way to 1,000. And he'd heard that this guy, the Buddha, whoever heck he was around. He was local. And he just and Angulimala decided, that's going to be my last finger. Yes, sirree. Meanwhile, the Buddha is heading out of this village, and he's heading in down a certain path, and the villagers are going, oh, don't go there, don't go there. That's where Angulimala hangs out in the woods there. You don't want to go down that path. And the Buddha just ignores him and just keeps on going. Angulimala sees the Buddha coming, and he's going to leap on him from behind and catch him and then kill him and chop off one of his fingers. But the Buddha just totally serene, keeps walking. And Angulimala is behind him, and he's shouting and he's yelling. But no matter how fast Angulimala runs, the Buddha just very calmly keeps gliding along. And Angulimala can never catch him. So the story goes. And he finally, Angulimala just was yelling, like, stop, stop, stop. How can you possibly be doing what you're doing? I don't understand. And the Buddha stopped and turned and taught him Dhamma. And Angulimala was so struck by the teachings that he became one of the Buddhist disciples and spent the rest of his life practicing. So his unwholesome intention shifted to something more wholesome. Interestingly, as the story goes on, because there's more to the story, he's one of the Buddha's disciples, and so he can't go around whacking people anymore. He can't act like he had been all his life. But he'd go into a village where he'd caused a lot of trouble, and the people would see him, and have his begging bowl, and people would put cow dung in his begging bowl instead of food, and just like treat him really poorly and yell at him and throw rocks at him. And Angulimala would go to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, well, this is the results of your previous actions. You treated these people poorly. This is now you have to learn to bear this, to be okay with the fact that this is part of the results of your actions. And Angulimala did, and apparently, the story ends with him becoming an enlightened being later on in life after many years of practice. It's just changing his intention from chopping off the Buddha's finger to becoming his student. So, how does this happen? And the main thing we have to understand is the path that we have to form an intention that essentially requires renunciation, which is not a very popular word, I know. Like there's a little, I love this little teaching story. You know, this was it's a classic, one of those classic cartoons where the guy's climbing up a mountain, you know, going up the mountain, and there's a he gets up to this little plateau, and there's a man in a white robe and a long white beard sitting there looking very, you know, calm and still. And the man goes up to, he decides he's gonna have to talk to this guy. He says, "Oh, great wise man, you know, how can I reach enlightenment?" And the wise man says, "Follow the path of renunciation." And the guy pauses for a second. He looks around and he said, "Is there anyone else up here I can talk to?" And this is the classic, you know, we think renunciation has a bad rep, right? It's not like, oh boy, let's do some more renunciation. And it's part of it, certainly in our culture these days, that's a bad reputation because supposed, you know what I'm saying, supposed in quotes, renunciates have acted very poorly, you know, sleeping with their students and that sort of stuff. I mean, there's just been a lot of stuff like that. I could make a long list of teachers I know of, or knew personally for that matter, who have acted very poorly in that particular area, and others, you know, collecting Rolls Royces from their students and things of that nature. And so it's like we sometimes people have they hear renunciation, they go, "Oh no, that's going to lead you into that sort of unwholesome way of living, you know, like getting caught up wanting things and taking advantage of people." And also, our culture sort of glorifies getting everything you can and not doing anything that isn't pleasurable, which seems to be the opposite of renunciation, right? The Buddha talks about the joy of renunciation a lot. And it's like that sounds like an oxymoron, right? The joy of renunciation. But here's the truth. As soon as we form the intention to put more energy into our practice, well, we're all living in the world, we only have so much energy to do stuff in the world. And if we're going to put more energy into our practice, then other things we do, often things that we like, we're going to have less time for them. It's just a fact. The more you put in, the more time and energy you decide to put into practice, the less time you're going to have to do whatever it is, you know, you like doing. You won't be able to do it so much, and maybe you're going to do it in a different way. You know, you're going to, you know, give up something to have more time to practice. And that's all renunciation means here. It means letting go of something so that we have more times to do something that we know is more wholesome and going to be more useful for us. Might mean we decide that we want to practice early in the morning, so we're going to have to go to bed earlier than we have been. You know, we're not going to stay up and watch the Late Late Show and all those talk shows that I have no idea what's on there because I've been going to bed early for like years. But you know, there's all kinds of stuff that people stay up and do, right? I know. Part of it also means, you know, someone's going to say, "Oh, why don't we all go have get together and stay up late and do this thing?" And you're going to go, "Nah. I'm going to go to bed early like I normally do so I can get up and practice." That's renunciation. That's all we're talking about here. Like looking and saying, do I really need to do that, or should I? And I'm not saying you shouldn't do have stay up late and have fun sometimes. I mean, that's everybody's has what works for them, right? It's just that we have to look at our lives and go, what is it I have to let go? What is it that I have to have less, do less of, think about less of, so that I can put more time and energy into my practice? And it's so simple, but it's so hard to do. That concept is simple, right? But it's like we have to actually, it's a conscious, this is a practice. Once again, oh, this is another practice. Just like wise view is a practice, this is a part of the practice. The other things, actually, I want to read a little bit more of Joseph here because he has things to say about this as well. And she's talking about how do we put wholesome view into practice? This is his theme. The question for us is how to put this step of the path into practice. In one discourse of the middle length discourses called The Two Kinds of Thoughts, the Buddha suggests one way to begin. Cultivate a clear discernment of the kinds of thoughts that arise in our minds. Just pay attention to what's arising in your mind. A clear discernment, right? We can notice that thoughts are rooted in desire, ill will, or cruelty, consciously reflect on the karma that they cause, and then abandon them, letting them go. So if we're paying, really being mindful and paying attention, we say, oh, look at that. I never thought of it that way, but I know where that goes. I how know how that affects the world, or affects me, or affects the people around me. Abandon them. But it requires that we're actually mindful of what's arising. And we can notice those thoughts inclining towards renunciation, goodwill, and compassion, reflect on their value, and then strengthen them in our lives. Oh, this one seems to be going in the right direction. Seems wholesome. Let's have more of that, please. As we become more mindful of these two classes of thoughts, we also become more aware of the strength and seductive powers of the unwholesome patterns. Oh, wouldn't it be nice to? I know I shouldn't have that second piece of chocolate cake, but I really want it. It's me, sweet tooth, right? Ill will and aversion are said to be more dangerous than greed and desire, but easier to uproot, whereas desire is less dangerous but harder to uproot. In other words, saying you can see really clearly when you're acting from a place of ill will or harm. It's pretty obvious this is not a wholesome thing to do. But the thing about desire is it has this sort of delusive quality of, well, only this once, or only just a little bit more, or whatever. Why is this? Ill will has more harmful consequences, but it's always unpleasant. When you're acting from ill will, at some level, it's always unpleasant. There might be this sort of like this sort of, I feel so good to whack this guy, or make him pay for what he did, or blah blah blah, whatever wherever we're going, the ill will. But it always, at some level, we sort of can feel it. Oh, isn't it always feels unpleasant when we look underneath that top layer of sort of sweet revenge, right? Sense desire, on the other hand, are usually associated with pleasure, and it's not always apparent why renouncing them is a good idea. It's a pretty interesting statement too, huh? Sense desires, on the other hand, are usually associated with pleasure, and it's not always apparent why renouncing them is a good idea. Well, what's one more piece of cake? I it's okay. I should be able to enjoy what I want. You know, it's a tricky place in our minds. Here he's talking about recognizing our own addictions. This is a bit further on. A more accurate and liberating understanding of renunciation would be as the experience of non-addiction. We all know the suffering bound up with addictions, whatever they might be. We might be addicted in one way or another to food, drugs, sex, alcohol, and perhaps more unnoticed to work, power, recognition, wealth, or even comfort. We can become addicted to and entranced by certain mind states and emotions, like excitement or intensity or fear. Witness the very big audiences for terrifying horror movies. Meditators can also get addicted to different meditative states like rapture or calm. How often in our practice are we trying to recreate some experience we've had before? We can get addicted to investigation. We can become overly fascinated with everything we're discovering. At one point in my practice in Burma, when I had been there for several months, the mindfulness had become very sharp, and I was seeing extremely minute details about what was arising. When I reported this to Sayadaw Pandita, that's his teacher, thinking that things were going very well, all he said was, "You're too attached to subtlety. You're too attached to subtlety." Ooh. It was such a powerful reminder that the practice is about renunciation, about letting go. Everything in our practice is in the service of that. It is best summed up in one line of the Diamond Sutra: develop a mind that clings to nothing. Develop a mind that clings to nothing. Even how wonderfully smart and how deep our practice is, and all those things we, if we're not careful, start clinging to. The other part of wholesome intention, I want to spend a little bit of time with. And that's loving kindness and compassion. Actually, consciously developing loving kindness and compassion. Like making these practices again, where we look for and are aware of opportunity for these things to grow in our lives. Where we see how, you know, we can act from a place of loving kindness more often, sometimes in very little ways. You know, just by being polite and friendly with the person who's checking out your groceries instead of ignoring them, for instance. Just you're checking out your groceries anyway, so why not just have a little sweet vibe go across at the same time? And they may be receptive to it and they may not, but that's okay. And with compassion, I think it's really important that we find opportunities to be of service in the world, to be useful in the world. This has got to be part of our intention, that we, you know, there are a million opportunities to volunteer in our culture, where we can do something and the only reason we want to do it is, yeah, I see there's some suffering there, and I can do a little bit to alleviate it. You know, and it could be as simple as, like, I go to the food bank once a week and help pack groceries into bags. It doesn't have to be some big thing. But it's like, that's, I think, it should be an active part of our practice as well. Doing something only because we see that the need for it, and we do it not because people will think how wonderful we are or how important I am to be volunteering my time when I could be doing those important things I normally do. But just do it out of compassion for the world, which is full of people who need a little bit of your compassion. This is also wholesome intention, right there in our daily lives in the world. So it's not just about practice in the sense of mental practice, it's about how we act in the world. We have to consciously change that as well, make that a priority more. Because as we cultivate those things, as we cultivate loving kindness and compassion, we're consciously opening ourselves to the fact that we're connected to everyone else. That if there's someone else there that isn't doing as well as I am for whatever reason, emotionally, mentally, physically, whatever, if I can give something to make their lives a little tiny bit better, then I'm doing something that acknowledges that we're all connected together, that we're not separate. It's just something to think about. Of course, I have a little bit of poetry to finish with. This is Dana Falls, one of my favorites from her book, Go In and In. And there's a poem called Surely This Is Love. Oh, this is great. I am intimately connected with all that is. When you water your roots, my heart blossoms. When I see you smile, that's when I know I'm fully alive. As you are able to live in truth, I raise the roof of this house I am exploring. I throw the doors wide, let the breeze blow in the windows. When you grow, I know it is my own opening. You stretch, I breathe. I give, you receive. Just beneath the fabric of our lives, coiled ready to spring, or budding like a rose, reaching out to embrace, or sitting, bathed in grace and stillness, this singing, circling, radiant, one with everything. Surely this is love. I second the sentiment.